From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense.
This week, Aaron asks Joey about being sexy on Halloween, and Joey asks Aaron about the current state of intimacy.
Woo! By the way, this is still what a Joey sounds like.
And this is still what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what a special guest host Halloween superstar Katie Sadow sounds like.
Ooh. This is a Katie.
Okay. Can we do like a quick housekeeping thing? The amount of backlash that I've had in reference to Michael Bublé is a little bit ridiculous. I didn't know there were so many Michael Bublé stands out there. My mother didn't appreciate it, apparently.
But also Bublé. Pronunciation is really effortless.
Michael Bublé. So what do you got for us, Aaron?
Yo, so it is, first of all, an exciting... Woo, that's the microphone. It's an exciting Thursday, Friday, Saturday... No, it's a Friday morning that we're recording this. But I think there's one thing that I'm excited for next Tuesday in particular. What are you guys doing next Tuesday? Do you know yet?
I might be voting.
You voting?
You vote?
Are you voting too?
Yes, I'm voting.
We voting. So number one thing, get out and vote. It is obviously incredibly important, and I don't think it needs to be said more so, but it does. So go do it.
We got a lot of housekeeping this week, and you need to vote.
That, yes, I do. Oh, like, to the point that I had to figure out I'm going to be out of town on Monday, had to get the absentee ballot, had to make sure it could get to my house in time, had to look it up, figure it out. I could not have done it on my own. I actually had a coworker help me figure out how to get that done and made sure that the rest of the team that's going to be out of town that day is doing it. So do one of two things. Get your shit together, register and vote, or help your friends, help your parents, help your colleagues, do something.
Lend a hand, give a ride.
Yeah, it's not that hard. Do it. It's important.
Borrow a bike.
What?
Use a skateboard.
But
get on a longboard, ride to vote.
Surf.
Surf to vote.
I don't like any of these modes of transit.
Shred the gnar to vote.
Oh, what? Can we just walk?
All right.
Anyway, okay. No, so there's another momentous occasion. This week, and that is spooky Halloween, right? New York City and Halloween are like peas and carrots. They shouldn't be on a plate together because they give me gas. Really, Halloween is really, really big in New York City, and so of course last week, all of my friends are going all out. I had one of my friends was the lamp from Christmas Story. Brilliant. Another one. There were a
third
lot of
best lamp you could be.
What second, are the other two?
Beauty and the Beast.
True.
First, lamp from Anchorman that Brick loves.
Okay, I've got a fourth that I do think is the fourth on the list, and that's the lamp from A Brave Little Toaster.
Lamp's got... What about the Pixar lamp?
Damn it, I was going to do
that. That is the Pixar lamp. Full circle. Anyways, Halloween.
Halloween. So the big question every year is, what are you going to be? What are you going to do? And of course, this question comes up every year. Why is Halloween so sexy? It's horrible. What?
I can't turn off the sexy. I'm sexy 365.
As soon as Justin Timberlake brought sexy back, I was hooked. I was done.
Why is it horrible?
So, this is my personal opinion. I think that costumes are awesome, and I think that costumes are all about creativity and putting yourselves in the shoes of fantastic fantasies that you don't live every day. The sexiness just makes me uncomfortable. It's literally that simple. I just feel a little uncomfortable.
Bringing the middle age back from last week.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a little bit of like man shakes fist at cloud, old man shakes fist at cloud, like get off my lawn. Like I think of Halloween as a vestige for childhood youth and freedom. And I think that's where I always sort of like anchor it in my head, even though I am self-admittedly the Halloween Grinch. I think of it as like a pure innocent time in my life. And so I kind of wish that like bled up into adults, but it doesn't seem as though it always does.
The Chiron currently under Aaron's face is reading, "Stop the war on Halloween."
Yeah. Never knew that me and Megyn Kelly would have so much in common. We're coming back to that in a minute.
Okay. I feel like this is a weird new idea, but I don't actually know that to be 100% true. But this idea of like sexy Halloween, and you know, we had a conversation a few weeks ago about the sexy Handmaid's Tale costume, which
it's so inappropriate on every level. Like, given the context of the show, the context of the character, like, it makes my head like actually hurt, just like melty a little bit.
I wonder if some of the problem is the manufacture of a costume that says this is a sexy costume. Mm. Like, is there a difference between someone dressing up as a piglet on their own and like showing some skin versus buying a costume that says it's called Sexy Piglet?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, what's really nice about that too is that it dovetails with non-Halloween cosplay. Like in like, you know, Comic-Con and all that, which unfortunately I find a way to bring into every podcast episode. But there's a lot of conversation in the cosplay community around being dressed up in costume in a character that has been imagined by someone else that might be skin revealing, but isn't an invitation like to be sexy. It's not like sexy katana from Mortal Kombat. It's just Mortal Kombat. And unfortunately, it is a very skimpy outfit.
Yeah, there's a couple questions I have. One, you know, is sort of why Halloween? Why, like, of all the things in the year, why is Halloween the sexy one? But the other part of it is sort of, you know, my immediate guess is just that you're being allowed to be someone else and everyone wants to feel sexy.
That's right, exactly what it is. I mean, Aaron came out and said it's an opportunity for people to try on a fantasy. And if there's any part of you that has a fantasy about being sexier than you are in your everyday life, this is like a socially acceptable context in which to own that.
Yeah. And it's so, it is interesting that there's not any other time that we allow ourselves in the U.S. like, you know,
I don't know where you go on Friday nights, but...
That is a very good point. Actually, there are many places that allow you to live said fantasies. But yeah, like that, it's not something that's like socially condoned broadly. Mm-hmm. And I literally every time I talk about this with friends, I have to bring up The Purge, because like The Purge is just Halloween like times 10
with murder.
Yeah. So the movie The Purge is like a horror movie from, I don't know, the past decade.
Maybe 10 years. Eight, ten years.
It's basically one day
a year.
They've
made four of them now, so
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so many. And the basic concept is on Halloween, you can go, or on one single specified day a year, all of society is completely free to do whatever they want, wherever they want. So it's murder, it's horror, but every other time, every other day of the year, society's perfect because it's been isolated to this one day.
Well, that's
cool.
Yeah.
That's dope.
Yeah. It's something.
Let's start the police
department just like not exist except for one day a year?
It's kind of like an exaggerated martial law, sort of like society controls itself, because this one day, if you pissed off the baker in February, you're going to see
that
customer
die?
Again. Yeah, probably.
Like, don't let your dog pee on my lawn.
No, I don't.
I don't have a lawn. No, my question is sort of to this sort of cosplay role-playing type of thing. My question is sort of like, it doesn't feel like we have a particularly sexually repressed, or it's not a particularly sexually repressed time and culture right now compared to other times. I'm sure you can look at, I mean, it. Yeah, maybe I'm sort of thinking about...
Being a man?
No, yeah.
Some of that we carry with us that helps.
No,
labor.
I just mean
how tight is your shirt right now? Yeah,
very. I'm not. This isn't a shirt.
Well, yeah.
This is painted on. I feel like people are like comfortable to wear like less clothes or to post things online of them feeling sexy or whatever. It feels like a time where you're sort of inundated with sexual imagery. So the idea of the need for just Halloween also is sort of a question of like, are we highly sexually repressed? And that's why this is sort of like that venting of that situation once a year, or, you know?
I don't know. Like, I feel like kind of the repression is not necessarily a symptom or indicated by its appearance, but more so its relationship to shame. And like, sex and shame are intrinsically linked in our society. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't let sex exist as pleasure. Sex is inherently like scary, othered, like dangerous. And I feel like that relationship being reinforced sometimes is why these hypersexualized images come out that are damaging, that are unreal, and that like are in some ways grotesque, like just in and of themselves. And so that sort of the reaction toward that relationship is something that makes things kind of icky to me.
I was just thinking of the Rob Riggle character in Mean Girls. If you have sex, you will get gonorrhea and you will die.
Yes. I mean, I'll say it. I mean, I went to Catholic school, grade school, K through 12, that whole thing. Sex was not exactly like, be positive, like enjoy this amazing aspect of like having a human body. Like,
I don't think they're doing that at public school either. FYI.
Yeah.
Fair point. It was not the Catholic school that did that. Fair. But like by comparison, when I went to college and I went to like hyper liberal college, it was the complete opposite. And my world was sort of shattered to think about sex as, oh, that can be a good thing. It's not inherently bad.
This is sort of the hitch point in all of this, right? Like, you just brought up body positivity and whatever, and you are a very body positive person in general, but
yeah, I work on it.
Yeah,
I do.
But this particular subject where it is sort of that get off my lawn, I like costume and cosplay. Why does Halloween have to be sexy? Is sort of like this weird intersection of Aaron where you're like, body positive, everyone do what you want. But then you're like, don't you stay away from my Halloween.
I definitely, it goes back to being the Halloween Grinch that I am. I think that it's a little bit scary when it's Halloween in general. I find the costumes related to Halloween always bring me anxiety. So again, back to Megyn Kelly, there is always some like college kid somewhere who's going to do blackface on Halloween. Like, it happens every year and it's so painful, frustrating, like all of the above. And I almost feel like I'm going around doing PSAs to people that don't need to hear it about, like, you know, the blackface isn't okay, right? Like, you can't do that. And there's so many other kind of layers that do make, I think, Halloween like something to consider a little bit more so now than ever before. So drag on Halloween is dressed like cross-dressing or dressing with another gender expression on Halloween as a costume. That's not the same for everybody. It almost starts to fall in line with, if you're doing it on that day, are you doing it to express more about yourself? Are you doing it to parody what it is to be the other gender? Is it supposed to be inviting social commentary? You can tell that I over-intellectualize everything about Halloween, but it brings me a lot of anxiety to think about what does it mean to dress as something else and someone else.
I think that's why you're so frustrated. You know, when you were six, it was like an opportunity to put on something that you didn't get to wear every day and eat a lot of candy and stay up late. And now you're in this situation where you're, I don't know, trying to take in all of the different levels of culture and societal turmoil via like the lady on the sidewalk dressed as something that she isn't.
You also... It's an interesting point is that when I think of sexy Halloween, I do think more so of men as sexy Halloween.
Oh,
which I think
right.
is an important like vantage point. I mean, I see a lot of like bare-chested, jacked superhero dudes in very little clothing all over the Halloween parties that I'm going to. And that's very triggering. And not, you know, it's like concerning to be like, you know, oh, what do I look like? I can't wear those sorts of things or that little of things. And what does that say about me? And it does invite this little microcosm of self-judgment that is uncomfortable and not fun on a day that you really just want to feel free and stay up late and eat candy, drink bourbon, whichever one it is.
Well, I think like part of this too is like what we've all been getting at going back to the Handmaid's Tale costume is what we all don't like is bad concept.
True.
And if you have if you're wearing a Handmaid's Tale costume that is like sexified, then you don't understand the show or whatever you're just choosing to put it on. Like, I think if you're just like, if you just paint an S on your bare chest and say you're Superman, like, that's not a Superman costume. And I think what we're talking about, like, if you were Conan, he was bare chested.
Yeah.
Then that costume makes sense.
I love me some creativity. I will say I love the mashup costumes, which my favorite of all time.
Like a pun costume?
Like a little, yes.
I want to ban those.
Ooh, have it out.
The noise that you just heard was my heart breaking out of my mouth, just shattering and like, bah! It was horrible.
You know what? Actually, I don't want to ban them for everyone. I just don't ever want to see them.
I thought you just want to ban them for me.
They've already been banned for me.
Well, so what if, for example, someone was Olivia Pope Francis and combined the character from Scandal and Pope Francis?
Okay, that's different. That's funny. What I'm talking about is, and this is going to sound like a dig, and it isn't one because this is a personal preference. Yeah. But like dragon fruit, like I'm an apple, but I've got dragon wings.
Mm-hmm. Meredith is not going to be happy.
That's a hard no for me.
Hard no. That's amazing. Wait, so what was the best Halloween costume that you ever had, Joey?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't know that I've had very many good ones. I am not like a historical Halloween aficionado. I've very much been it's the 31st at 3 p.m.
And
I need to find something
car.
In my closet yep. and make something up immediately. And yeah. so, or like go to Goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I have very many good ones.
Well then, Katie, what about you? What have you been proud of in past Halloweens or this Halloween?
I think, I don't know if it's really my place to be proud, but I can be proud of my mother for the bumblebee costume she made for me when I was 2 years old.
Nice.
I think that was probably my peak.
I peaked at two. Yeah.
I feel you.
I feel like you have something on the tip of your tongue, Aaron.
Yeah, he's like, I'm going to ask these people about their costumes so that I can tell you about my top five.
Yeah, whether or not I'm a Halloween Grinch is definitely coming into question. Two. One, just like you, my mom making me a wizard costume when I was like 9. Love it so much. The other was when I was both Dolores Van Cartier and Sister Mary Clarence in one night from Sister Act.
I just wish I had known you during that time.
It was good. It was good. That was the year that I was.
Were you like half and half? Like,
no, it was a big reveal halfway through the night. Payettes. That's basically
what
happened. Yeah. It was good. It was good. Got on stage a couple times.
I was expecting like the bisection of like half of your body is one and half of your body is the other.
That's my friend Alex who did Gomez Adams and Morticia Adams completely Fierce. Down the center. It was amazing. He's also the one that did the leg lamp. He's got a lot of good ones. Violet Beauregard that blew herself up all night long. Like he inflated in the middle of the room at different. It was yeah. He's a lot.
Violet, you're turning Violet. Violet.
Yeah.
But, oh, okay. You really had her last name ready to go.
I always think about Miss Beauregard. She's intended to be Beauregarded.
Nope.
Nah, fell flat. Okay, so the thing that I think we can do to sort of wrap this up is to know two things. Number one, Halloween actually started as this, like, basically Gaelic festival that was about lighting bonfires and warding off ghosts. Like, that was kind of the heritage of it. Then it became Christianized with All Hallows Eve, Pope Gregory, and all that kind of stuff. And then we sort of secularized it into this, like, eat candy and, like, go crazy on the 31st. That's just your little tidbit of knowledge that everybody needed to have about where this glorious but terrible holiday came from. Again, bifurcation. It is who I am. The second thing is that, you know what? I think that we should spread the energy of Halloween all throughout the year. And if that means that you want to be sexier throughout the year, great. And if it's about you, great. But let's stop marketing sexy blank costumes and actually just like let you choose how you want to express yourself. That's my POV and I'm sticking to it.
Aaron Powers, Normcore Halloween.
We're back. Joseph, Katie, we're back.
Hi.
Hi, it's me.
Woo.
And me.
And you. What's been on your mind, Joseph?
So it's not unrelated, actually, in our continued accidental merging of topics to some of what you were talking about. I've been thinking a lot about social media, but as we all have coming up to the election in terror and whatever. But in some of that reflection, I've been thinking about the impact that it has on our relationships. And so the question I have for you before we start digging into it is, what does intimacy look like in a social media mediated world? So I can give a little bit of background while we all giggle at the dance we were doing in between that click clack.
Yes.
So intimacy, at least in the way that psychologists define intimacy, is about mutual self-disclosure, right? Like, we are intimate if we talk about something with each other and we both share, right? Mm-hmm. So like, mm-hmm. I tell you something vulnerable about myself and you tell me something vulnerable about you, and everything is great. And that can be social intimacy, as well as obviously you can go into sexual intimacy. That's not what we're talking about. But there, I've been looking at a bunch of data this week, just sort of nerding into this. And there's some weird correlations that are like sort of circling around this, right? So on social media, there was a study done, and we'll put the study up on the website. This is nonsense.com. But basically, like, people on social media have a negative reaction to people who overshare. So if you find a moment on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, whatever, to share something about yourself that feels like more intimate than people think it should be, they immediately have a negative reaction to that. And that particular study says, like, if someone does that in public that you don't know particularly well, that happens as well. I think the difference is we're increasing the volume of communication that we have in our everyday life to be in social media. Mm-hmm. And so that's a particular moment where intimacy is being frowned upon, right? Like, this increasing chunk of your pie graph of communication with the people you know is falling in social media, and people don't want you to be sharing. And the other part of that is lurking, right? So mutual self-disclosure. If I go on social media and share something that you guys think is too intimate about myself, and you're just reading it and not sharing anything back, that intimacy doesn't exist. You might feel like you have some intimacy with me because you know a thing, but I don't know anything about the people who are lurking there reading that thing. So that sort of dynamic is dying.
I have a question about where the line is drawn between what's acceptably intimate and what's too intimate. Mm-hmm. So like, in these people that are part of the study you're talking about reacting poorly to oversharing or overly intimate sharing, it feels like that bar moves depending on how well you know the person. Mm-hmm. And that's why social media is complicated in a way that the public real world isn't, because you're not likely, unless you're listening to someone else talking on the train, to hear, you know, a really heartfelt or, I don't know, just overshare.
But I think you get feedback, right? So if I share a story about, you know, if I share some weird poop story on social media,
intimate,
and you guys and you two think that it's funny or something and like it, but overall I have a dramatically smaller response to that post versus me being like, the Celtics are great, like, and everyone's like, yeah, Celtics, except for Aaron apparently.
Yeah, it's a Boston
but like, you're getting feedback on those overshares, where within your more tight friend group your people might respond, but overall it's getting a less response, and so you start to do that thing less.
But there's also, I guess this is exactly what you're saying too, Katie, where it's like, if I know you, there's an issue with social media not being an intimate forum, and yet it being sort of marketed as an intimate forum.
Right.
Like friending people on Facebook. I have probably 10 friends, real friends on Facebook, but there are like
thousands. Should we friend each other?
Oh, I guess we do need to do that. It would be a lame
movie up to 11.
Really, that would make me happy. And when you're in broadcast mode, there are things that allow for the types of feedback that are useful and that allow for an exchange of ideas that builds intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you're just throwing things out in the ether, and I don't care. I'm also the Twitter curmudgeon. I'm so curmudgeonly today.
Not today.
Year-round curmudgeon. I don't like Twitter because I can't figure out a way to filter the output, or the input, I should say, from the entire world in a way that I really care about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do Instagram. I don't do any of them really because I just don't want to take the time to all of a sudden figure out how to welcome the world's crap into my universe,
mm-hmm.
and then have to go through the process of filtering out like all of the stuff that I don't want.
Right.
Feels like it's an exercise in eliminating noise rather than like getting information about the things that I love from the people that I care about.
Yeah, there are these studies that are done that say that, you know, and there's terminologies, and we can throw links up on the website as well. Second plug for thisisnonsense.com. Didn't mean it. But there are studies that show that your social network, like any kind of complete social network for a person, can't really be bigger than 150 or so people. And by the time you have your immediate family, and then you kind of go out a little bit, and it's your close, tight group of friends, and then acquaintances, and then, you know, your neighbor that you see often, but you can remember their name and whatever. And, you know, now we have thousands of people for some folks on Facebook or Instagram.
Oh, do we?
Yeah.
Somebody's popular.
My followers, I don't. But
I don't believe you. Yeah. Many thousands.
I have thousands of followers. But I think like that idea, right? Like that is inherently you're distributing your intimacy over a wider range of people because you're trying to keep track of them.
But can you really distribute intimacy? You know,
I think
mean?
You can. Like there's other data that I have here that is
fight with data.
Yeah, that is basically showing that like we're in the U.S. we're increasingly becoming lonely. Like there was a big study done by Cigna, the insurance company, using this UCLA loneliness test. And they did it with like thousands of people, and they found that 54% of people qualified as being lonely in the United States based on statements like 56% reported that they sometimes or always felt like people around them are, in quotes, are not necessary with them, or are not necessarily with them. 2 in 5 felt like they lack companionship, that their relationships aren't meaningful, and that they are isolated from others. 54% of Americans feel lonely. Like we are somehow distributing our intimacy. We're not making connections.
Well, how often are you in a room with people where people are just looking at you, interacting with you? You know, like 54% of the time, I would say I'm in a room with people and at least half the people in the room are on their phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very
while
true.
I'm having a conversation with them while we're eating dinner.
Sorry, what was that? I was just checking Twitter.
It's so true.
The curmudgeon in me is coming out now. This is my this is my issue. Yeah. I have like a no phones at the dinner table policy. Like can't handle it. Yeah, how are you supposed to build relationships with people if they're building relationships with thousands of other people on the internet while you're trying to talk to them?
Yeah, distributing your intimacy.
Okay, fine. Distributing intimacy can be a thing. But it's not just a feature of the digital age. Like this has been happening and it's been in decline since even the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sociologist who wrote a book, Robert Putnam, I believe is his name. We'll double check that. But Bowling Alone is the book. And it's about the decline in America of
bowling.
Really civic bowling. But the general conversation in the book is how civic connectivity is dropping throughout America.
Community.
The sense of community is disappearing. And they were talking about, and Bowling Alone has to do a lot with bowling leagues in the 50s and how bowling leagues were a place for people to come together. And actually, if you look at that, the phenomenon of bowling leagues in the U.S. and how it's declined, you see it also correlating with a decline in connectivity to other sort of civic engagements like voting or like being in the Boy Scouts or mm-hmm. like all these organizations that have these almost civic pseudo governmental civic connections.
Well, that lines up with the suburbs too, right? Like being distributed out spatially inherently means that you're going to be connecting with less people because you're not physically close to as many people as well, right?
But in contrast, today in cities, there's a lot. So there's a lot, and actually, we'll put a link to this too. The Economist was doing some work, some data analysis work for the midterms, and one of the factors that's so important to their analysis was clustering, and how more and more people are clustering together in cities. Mm-hmm. So now, if you think about the flip side of this digital loneliness that's happening when we're actually getting more and more physically close together, it's this weird, like, how is it that we're now like no longer distributed farther apart and trying to connect with each other? We're actually close to, on top of each other and super alone all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, clustering to me sounds like it's people coming together. I mean, what's interesting is that I feel like anecdotally, like to your point, Katie, about like no phones at the dinner table, I've seen an increased push to start to establish new mores around whether it's digital media specifically or just phones and technology broadly. Like people are increasingly establishing new mores that are new based on the fact that the technology itself is new. And you're seeing technology companies start to jump on board with that. Like Apple's recently launched that activity monitor of seeing how often your screen is on and what you are using it for. Google's been doing the JOMO thing, joy of missing out instead of fear of missing out, and trying to push for people to have a healthy relationship with technology. And so it feels like there is some anecdotal push back. I don't know how strong that is or if it's just like it happens to be in sort of people in my circle that are doing those things.
Well, it's kind of like technology is one way in which there's certainly a barrier that technology introduces as far as intimacy goes. But then again, in the physical world and in social media spaces, you have this, again, clustering of like-minded people who are getting into political conversations, and everybody basically wants to get in their own echo chambers.
I see what you're talking. You're talking about like cliques and stuff, like people Absolutely. Like only in the urban centers, like people grouping together with similar people to them, and instead of sort of that, like, you know, heterogeneous mixture of
exactly
people.
Yeah. It's like we've got more people on one hand who are sharing thoughts with other people who are going to be a reflection of their own opinions, which is in a way for sure intimacy. Like it's sharing that sort
it's
of
tribalism
again,
though,
which is
yeah
you know,
no yeah
the glue of that is intimacy. But that tribalism is not about like growing relationship or, well, it is literally about growing relationship, but it's not about.
It's like confirmation bias in your community.
It's self-indulgence. It's a little bit of like eating a delicious pastry that is injected with, it's like a giant cream puff that you just eat over and over and over and
Candy.
Over again.
Is that a problem?
No.
Absolutely you look like you not. Have something that you're like processing, Katie. No.
No, I guess I'm thinking along a slightly off-topic track.
Take us there.
Which has to do with what does it mean for people like BFFs or couples who are demonstrably intimate digitally. How does that affect what it is to be demonstrably intimate physically, not sex?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wah, wah, wah. But like
saxophone.
But just in sort of the real world together. I'm thinking of applying for internships when I was in college and having an internship that I really, really wanted and applying online and following up via email a handful of times and then just calling the contact, not cold calling because I had applied, but calling and saying, hi, you know, I'm this person from this application and I'm really interested in the position and I would love to talk a little bit more about it. And they ended up giving me the position, and the man who was recruiting or who was running the application process ended up telling me later that I was the only person of my generation who had called him on the phone. Yeah. And it just makes me think, you know, like,
you're not of this generation.
It makes me think of, you know, all the like hearts at my bay and mm-hmm. like happy 30th birthday to the most beautiful boy I've ever known on social media. And like, are you saying that in person? Are you saying that so that the world sees that you're not alone? Or are you saying that because you love somebody?
Like, yeah, it's performative. It feels like in a lot of cases. I mean, there is this thing that's showing up around social anxiety with younger folks than ourselves that have sort of had most of their social interactions digitally mediated in some way.
Exactly.
And they're going into job interviews or social interactions or trying to date or things like that, and they have no idea how to interact in person. And that is, right, like talking about, you know, this is sort of a cascade effect, right? Like if you can't interact meaningfully in person, then you can't build intimate relationships, then you're gonna feel lonely and so on and so forth. And I think there, you know, I don't know whether digital media inherently or technology inherently kills intimacy or that we need to do things to sort of restore it, but it feels like it's an important thing. We're social animals and finding ways to be intimate with one another.
There is a digital intimacy. Like I think, even though the connections are different and there is the ability to perform perhaps more in a more curated fashion digitally, when you think about what text you're going to send, when you think about what this is going to look like on social media, what this adding filters to things, like you can really do that. What are you thinking, Katie?
Well, I'm thinking so digital encompasses social media, but it encompasses other things. And to me, the distinction is social media is broad, but there is intimate digital communication, which is not broad. Like when you can be private, you can be vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way that's meaningful, the same way that building relationships in person used to be meaningful.
Yeah, you got
to
slide into those DMs.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Oh, and then you post what you said in the DMs to the entire universe.
Yeah, I think that's the point too of your like, hearts at my bay and happy 30th birthday.
Hard eyes.
Yeah. I think that point is like in that moment, that's performative. It's not intimate. It's not mutual. Like even in like DMs or text messages or whatever, there is mutual interaction. So it's a mutual self-disclosure. If I'm writing hearts at my bay to everyone I know, that doesn't feel like it's a special meaningful thing just for them. And so the other part of it too, and the last part I wanted to make is just the feeling like you can't truly be yourself in these platforms, that you're constantly self-editing is also an inhibitor to intimacy.
Truth.
Right, like we're, and this fits with, I mean, our culture is going through a lot that we need to correct for, and I think that's important, but in sort of the correction, a lot of people are retracting because they're afraid to say anything because they're worried of call out culture or these other things. And so that retraction winds up meaning like you don't express your opinions or whatever, because you're just like, I'm not going to say anything because it's scary out there. And you might not have anything that is a reason to be scary in your head or your heart, but like, they're like, I'd rather not. So you're not being honest in those communications either.
Yeah. And actually, on the extreme flip side of that, you could also be saying things that are just there to be provocative, like just there to like stir up conversation and get attention for poking the imaginary bear.
Milo Yiannopoulos.
There's not a person who makes my blood boil more. But I think that does sort of like, that is a nice way to sort of wrap it up. Like what is this intimacy?
Yeah.
It is intimate.
I wanted to end on a song, but I couldn't quite love the one you're with.
Oh, I was gonna end on Miss You. Life the Desert.
That's fine, okay, too. I mean, if you wanted to go back to Sexy Halloween, I feel like there's a lot more fodder there for making songs.
All right, so end us on a song.
Yeah.
If you want my body and you.
Oh, Rod Stewart came back. Yeah. We're going full circle. Happy Halloween, y'all.
Peace.
Bye.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in beautiful MacGyver Studios in New York, New York.
We'd like to thank special guest Katie Sadow for her superpowers and little piggy costume.
Yes, executive producer and on-air advocate Jess Vander.
Sound magician and audio aficionado Alex Contell.
Designer and all-around care bearer of a human, Nora Mestrich.
With production help from Sarah Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Vuong.
And thanks to Lance Sylvain.
We also have many special thanks to the men with S's painted on their chests at Aaron's Halloween party.
I'd also like to thank, I don't have one yet.
Shout out at Cream Puffs.
Ooh, Cream Puffs. I heard that.
I also want to thank, I still don't have one.
I don't want to thank Michael Bublé, and I'm not sorry about it. Sorry, Michael.
I would like to thank Rod Stewart for showing up again.
I think that's all the thanks we have until Thanksgiving.
Oh, so much turkey. Okay, bye.
Irish Thanksgiving? What is happening?
Get ready with your lucky charms.